I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of September. Hour one of our program today, The Shackling of the American City. Henry Grabar is the author of a piece that appears in Slate. Local governments want to set their own minimum wage, gun laws, and smoking bans, and state houses have methodically stripped away their powers to do so. Actually, the article starts with the story about Wisconsin in May of 2011. Governor Scott Walker approving Senate Bill 23, prohibiting the state's municipalities from enacting paid sick leave laws. Only one jurisdiction in the state had a paid sick leave law on the books, and that happened to be Milwaukee, a Democratic stronghold. But I thought we'd start our conversation by talking about what the NCAA announced yesterday. They're going to relocate all seven previously awarded championship events from North Carolina during this academic school year. They made the decision because of the cumulative actions taken by the state concerning civil rights protections. Many of these were to take place in Charlotte, and Charlotte had passed an anti-discrimination law, but North Carolina laws invalidate any local law that treats sexual orientation as a protected class or has a purpose to prevent discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender individuals. So we're going to look at the many pieces of legislation, the action that has taken place in state houses, and it may be more important and noteworthy because of the impasse that we've been experiencing in Washington, D.C. for some time. We're delighted to have Henry with us this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Henry, hello. Thank you very much for being with us and for writing such an interesting article.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Why don't we start with the NCAA, because it was in the news today with the NCAA saying that they are going to relocate all of their seven previously awarded championship events from North Carolina. I know this wasn't ALEC-inspired, but it really goes to the theme of what you're talking about with North Carolina law invalidating any local law that would feel otherwise about this particular issue.
Yeah, I think what's happening in North Carolina demonstrates the extent to which preemption has moved to be a kind of a knee-jerk, a reflex movement for state houses when they see something they don't like at the municipal level. And it's often couched in the language of, ensuring a uniform regulatory system and protecting businesses. But I think the North Carolina case is an example of where that sort of where the lines start to blur, and really, I think this has been called the bathroom law, right? North Carolina HB2, but really, what it does is it invalidates a number of municipal ordinances that have been passed in Charlotte and other North Carolina cities that offered civil rights protections to gay, lesbian, transgender individuals. So. It's not a huge surprise that the NCAA has decided to pull out their events. We saw that the NBA pulled the All-Star game from Charlotte back in July. So I think this will put the pressure on the governor. So we'll see what happens.
Will it, do you think, change things? Because having all these championships is a moneymaker for the state, but people love athletic events, too, and championships. You would think that a lot of people are saying, oh, we don't like this.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's not the first time that we've seen a state preemption law become the subject of a kind of boycott, or at least inspired businesses to take their activities elsewhere. Arizona's immigration law that passed a few years ago and then was largely turned over by the Supreme Court also prompted a kind of boycott. You had a lot of performers who were scheduled to perform in Phoenix and Tucson deciding that they were going to skip the state in protest of the law. So we'll see how effective this is. I would say that the North Carolina Republican Party's response was not exactly apologetic. Let's see what they said here. They said, so absurd, it's almost comical. I genuinely look forward to the NCAA merging all men's and women's teams together as a singular unified unisex teams. So it does not sound like they are walking back the policy in light of the NCAA's decision.
No.
Of course, it's only been a few hours. So.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it develops. You start your story by talking about Senate Bill 23 in the state of Wisconsin, which prohibited the state's municipalities from enacting paid sick leave laws. And since 2011, this is a tactic that's only grown in state houses, Republican state houses around the country. What happened in May of 2011 here?
So, represents the culmination of a multi-year battle that had played out over Milwaukee's paid sick leave law. And the ordinance in Milwaukee was approved back in 2008, and it got 69% of the vote. So it was a pretty overwhelming approval, and it would have required large businesses to offer full-time workers nine paid sick days a year, and smaller businesses with fewer than 10 employees to offer 5 sick days a year. And, you know, as expected, it was caught up in a legal challenge. But I think by 2011, it had been ruled constitutional by the District Court of Appeals in Wisconsin. And then in May, Governor Scott Walker signed Senate Bill 23, which was a classic preemption law saying no city, town, county, village in Wisconsin may pass a law mandating paid sick leave from businesses. So, and that was the end of the Milwaukee paid sick leave ordinance.
Mm-hmm. And yet you also quote the governor here, who said when you send power back to the level closest to the people is generally the best. Sort of flies in the face of that philosophy that he articulated, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there is a conflict there Yeah, there are definitely some issues that even conservatives like Governor Walker, who espouse local control, have decided that are best resolved at the state level. And, you know, those are issues where in some cases, I mean, let's not talk about North Carolina right now, but at least for these sort of economic initiatives where cities are passing, say, a minimum wage law or a paid sick leave law, a lot of the conservative state houses will say we are passing this law to ensure sort of limited government. So there is a sort of philosophical consistency there. But on the other hand, does it really count as limited government if limited government is being enforced by the state? So it's sort of limited government by force, not by choice. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and it's not just Wisconsin either. I mean, it's happening, it's really happened all across the country.
You write that ALEC has successfully pushed preemption into more and more areas of GOP policy. Remind us of when ALEC was founded, what ALEC is, and how they have pushed this agenda.
Right, so ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're a 43-year-old organization. They're founded in 1973, and they bring together state legislators with representatives of corporations, and they write laws that are business-friendly. And they've been very successful. So they draft these model policies, which then get passed at the state level, and they've been very successful getting the laws that they discuss at their annual meetings and their committees passed in the states. And so they, you know, with the preemption thing, it's sometimes hard to parse exactly what their influence has been when you go back 20 years, because for a long time they were quite secretive. That's not really the case so much anymore. They become much more open, and they publish their model policies online. But generally, we can say that, you know, they were in support and helped propagate laws like state laws, for example, that preempted local gun laws. If a city wanted to say you can't carry a gun on the beach here, many states have laws that make that kind of municipal prohibition illegal. And I think there's actually a case right now in Wisconsin that's at the state Supreme Court over the city of Madison's ban on guns on public buses. Gun rights advocates are in the Wisconsin Supreme Court right now trying to convince the Supreme Court that Madison cannot ban guns from city buses because Wisconsin has a what they call Act 35, which is the concealed carry law, which preempts local governments from imposing gun regulations.
So some of these pieces of legislation could be overturned, but it has to be at the court?
Right. Well, the reason that the Wisconsin law is in the Supreme Court is because the prohibition on guns has actually been passed by the transit agency. And so it's sort of a loophole where the city is saying, well, you know, you have this state preemption law, but it only applies to city and towns, cities and towns, whereas our law is an initiative that's a sort of a rule of the transit agency, which runs the buses. You know, in short, cities actually have very little recourse when they get preempted at the state level. That's just the way the system is designed. Cities are subordinate to states, and I think people on both sides of the aisle would acknowledge that. And yet, you know, for many years there was a strain of thought. I mean, it goes back all the way to Alexis de Tocqueville, the French philosopher who visited the United States in the early 19th century, and he was looking around at these New England towns, and he said they were small independent republics over matters of local concern. And he wrote that they're independent in all the concerns themselves, and among the inhabitants of New England, I believe that no man is found who acknowledges that the state has any right to interfere in their local interests. And so this battle between state and local autonomy has gone on for, you know, basically 200 years. And starting in the late 19th century, you had all these states decided that actually they wanted to give a little more power to their cities. So Missouri passed a home rule law in 1875, Wisconsin passed one in 1925, and what these laws did was they delegated a lot of powers down to the local level. So of course that was a decision made by the state, but you know, once made, it set in motion this chain of events that we're seeing come to a head today, where you've got cities that say, you know, we've got our own issues and we need to address them with our own laws, and states trying to clamp down on their ability to do that.
So have there been challenges if it was home rule adopted in Wisconsin in 1925? Couldn't there be challenges to these preemptions just on the basis of this is unconstitutional?
Yeah, well, the home rule law, I think, is pretty general. And so that's why in state houses like Wisconsin's, the state legislature is passing these bills that are super specific and that say exactly what it is that cities are not allowed to do. And it's sort of funny because this is actually one of the reasons that home rule happened in the first place, was that the state legislators were tired of spending so much time in the state house making individual laws for individual cities. And saying, you know, I read an example from Massachusetts, for example, which was pretty late to home rule. But you know, the state legislators were like, this is ridiculous. We can't be deciding all these local issues up here. It's taking up too much time. So, and now you're seeing a reversal of that where, right, when they want to stop cities from doing a particular thing, they need to pass a law that explicitly prohibits that. So. Mm-hmm. That's what you're seeing with, like, you know, dozens and dozens of preemption laws that are tailored, almost laser-focused, not just on specific types of ordinances, but really on specific cities that have taken particular initiatives. And, of course, they don't say that because states aren't allowed to pass, you know, it would be quite irregular for them to pass a law that was about one particular city. But you know, that's really what it is.
Mm-hmm. You quote the director of the Oakland, California-based nonprofit Grassroots Change, who's the founder of Preemption Watch. I didn't even know there was such an organization, who says what's made these past 3 years so radically different is the strategy of preempting everything that cities and counties could do. So a couple questions. First is, has it really been a movement that's been particularly active in the past 3 years or so, and why?
Well, I think think, you know, we can sort of trace the roots of this to the 80s and 90s when tobacco and gun companies started realizing that there were local laws being passed that were hurting their business interests. And the famous example of this is probably smoking bans, where you had, which really started at the local level. You had cities and towns saying, you know what, we don't want people smoking in restaurants. We don't want people smoking on the beach. We don't want people smoking on the bus. And that was a sort of impetus for the first wave of preemption laws, which were state laws saying, actually, no city can make any laws about smoking, and no city can make any laws about guns. And what began with that has now progressed into a vast, vast array of different policy concerns. So ALEC has been a proponent of a number of preemption bills that target economic issues. So you've got the, for example, the paid sick leave bill, which after it passed in Wisconsin, was passed around at the ALEC conference in New Orleans and has since passed in almost a dozen states. Mm. And they, you know, they also have laws, model policies saying no city may enact a tax or a ban on plastic bags. So it gets down to stuff that would seem to be quite small scale. But then, of course, it's also spread beyond pure economic stuff. And the North Carolina law is a good example of that, where suddenly, you know, the philosophy that it's the state defending business interests gets a little confused when you've got a state like North Carolina that's making decisions on behalf of the state's cities that are, you know, decisions that are having a quite pronounced and explicit effect on the state's business climate,
right,
as we see from the decisions by the NBA and the NCAA to pull their events out of the state.
Mm-hmm. What about minimum wage? Has been used there? A lot of cities have enacted minimum wage.
Yeah, so minimum wage has been a very popular one. And I think minimum wage is a good example because it shows, you know, if you want to talk about why preemption is so popular now, you also have to look at why cities have taken an interest in passing all these laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a large extent they're responding to inaction on both the federal and state levels. So minimum wage is a great example of that. If you adjust for inflation, minimum wage has barely changed since 1968. In fact, it's lower now, adjusted for inflation, than it was in 1968, and it's about at its lowest point that it's been. And that's the sort of bare minimum federal minimum wage. And as you know, incomes are stagnating, and despite the news, you know, good news today on the household median income, but still, you know, people are struggling to get by. And so I think that's where cities have said, wait a second, you know what, we can do something about this.
Yes.
And I think the evidence has shown that to a large extent, you know, there's really no evidence that the businesses flee across the county line when they're subject to a minimum wage, because you put more money in the pockets of the workers, that money goes right back into the economy. These are people who are going right around and spending that money immediately. So I think, and what you see in the minimum wage laws at the city level is an example of why preemption is so popular, right? Responding to inaction on the part of the state. So that's what you're seeing with minimum wage. That's what you saw with the smoking stuff. And that's what you're seeing with some of the other examples of preemption where cities are saying, you know what, if the state's not going to do anything about this, then we're going to take matters into our own hands. And in some cases, for example, the smoking bans, that's actually started a genuine movement that's, you know, risen up from the local level to become base almost national policy that you can't smoke inside. I mean, I think there's probably a few places left where you can smoke in, say, restaurants. But by and large, it's become not just illegal, but I think it's socially unacceptable. And so that's an example where we have these laws trickling up from the local level. More often, though, you're seeing situations like what you have in Wisconsin where cities try and do this stuff and then they are shut down by their state legislatures.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're talking about the article written in Slate by our guest this hour, The Shackling of the American City, and he looks at legislation that really has been fashioned by ALEC, pushing preemption into more and more areas of GOP policy: guns, tobacco, sanctuary cities, pesticides, municipal broadband, minimum wage, and the list goes on. The preemption has become, partially because ALEC has very successfully promoted this, according to our guest, the most powerful statehouse tactic of our time. And he starts the article with a case, actually, in the state of Wisconsin back in 2011, when Milwaukee had passed a referendum on paid sick leave. It had been tied up on the courts, but it was made into law that no community would be able to enact such an ordinance in the state of Wisconsin. Here's our phone number. We have one line open for you. 800-486-8655 is our number. Henry Grabar is our guest. He's a journalist who wrote this piece in Slate. He writes about cities, maps, machines, staff writer at Slate. He was also senior editor at Urban Omnibus, the magazine of the Architectural League of New York, and author of the Science of Cities column for Next City and the Dream City column for Salon. We're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls now for Henry, and let's start with Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I just want to, I'm sure your guest knows this, but what's really insidious about preemption is that in 2010, the Republicans, with the help of ALEC, gerrymandered all of Wisconsin's state and congressional and assembly districts. And that's on appeal in the federal courts now. But what preemption does is, like, for example, in the last election cycle, 51% of Wisconsinites voted for Democrats in the assembly, but only 37 were seated because of the gerrymandered districts. And what preemption does is it violates one man, one woman, one vote, because it allows a majority gerrymandered party to dictate social and economic policy. And I'll take your guest comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks for your call, Jim. That's a great point. That is the case in many states, and it's not just a gerrymandering problem where you have the party that's in control redesigning the districts to ensure political hegemony, but it's also that I think state legislatures are biased against cities. And this is just longstanding, this is just the longstanding design of the American Republic, is that urban voters get shorted. And that is what, I mean, that is an important part of this preemption debate for sure. And it's not just Wisconsin, I think, that in which that's the case.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. We go next to Dave in Blue Mound. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Kathleen. Two quick points. The first being that the 1996 Romer v. Evans precedent related to a preemption law in Colorado. It was basically an anti-gay law. And under that precedent, HB 2 in North Carolina is almost certainly unconstitutional. Now, it's not true of all such laws, but in that particular case, it very likely applies. The second point is that HB 2 was definitely both an anti-labor law, because it did apply, it basically prohibited the cities from creating their own minimum wages. And then it was also, I think, as much an election year strategy as anything else by the GOP. You know, basically to motivate the base.
Mm-hmm. You agree, Henry?
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. I think that the backlash to HB 2, I mean, I think it's quite possible that it could be found unconstitutional, but, you know, that may take months, if not years, for that to happen. But I think we've also seen cases where these state-level anti-gay laws have had a backlash. I think that's the perception that I got when I was in Indianapolis, and they were talking about Indiana's religious freedom bill, which allowed businesses to discriminate against gays and lesbians. And my understanding there was that people were fed up with the bad attention that it had brought to Indiana. And so I wonder how that's going to work out in North Carolina. As you say, it's an election year, and I think that the Democratic Party in North Carolina has got a it's got Roy Cooper running for governor. I think they're really going to seize upon this, and they're going to make this a major issue. They're going to talk about all the money the North Carolina cities are losing as a result of the state, as a result of the HB2 law. So, you know, it may motivate the GOP base, but I think it may also might push a lot of business-friendly centrist voters towards the Democrats, too.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably just the beginning of the number of organizations, public employees. If you're supposed to go to a meeting or something, you won't have meetings in North Carolina for those states that have passed their own ordinances. A lot of people aren't going to North Carolina, and that list is only going to grow, isn't it?
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, these as I said, these state-level boycotts, you know, they make a lot of noise, for sure. The Arizona 1070 boycott, when I was looking up, you know, whether it was possible to quantify the economic effects of, you know, the various performers skipping out on Arizona and other states passing laws saying no official government travel to Arizona, you know, it wasn't exactly clear to me whether that it had a huge economic effect. One thing's for sure, it had a political effect. I think, you know, people in Phoenix especially were pretty put off by it, and I think that it did serve as a sort of rallying cry for the other side.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more. You were in Indianapolis for a meeting of ALEC. Is that what it was?
That's right. That was the ALEC's annual meeting was in Indianapolis this year. I was there. Both sort of, you know, they don't let reporters watch them actually draft and approve the model policies, sort of debate the language. But you do get to spend some time there and get a sense of the general, the vibe. And I was there in particular to watch the proceedings of the American City County Exchange, mm-hmm. which is a 3-year-old branch of ALEC that aims to do what ALEC has done for the states at the city and county level, which is sort of, in a sense, I mean, at first I thought there was a certain irony there because ALEC had been so focused, generally speaking, to the extent that ALEC had an urban policy, it was in disenfranchising urban residents and nullifying the statutes and ordinances that they had chosen for themselves. And the ACCE is basically on board with that theory of government. Some of the bills that they draft and elect as model policies are more or less reiterations at the local level that X or Y power belongs to the state. You know, they serve, you know, and to some extent, I think, you know, a lot of their members are actually really great local politicians and trying to do the best thing for their constituents. But I think that, you know, as an organization, one thing that they accomplish is they put a local face on these preemption laws. You know, they're available as a voice, representing, I should say, local governments who are in favor of not having control over, say, the minimum wage or the ability to regulate plastic bags.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I got confused because you talked about one, I can't remember what city, if it was Fort Wayne or Indianapolis, where they were enacting right-to-work legislation. Now, doesn't that, for that particular municipality or for that particular city, isn't that at cross-purposes of maybe the philosophy, if you have a Republican-led legislature, the philosophy might be similar, but isn't it at cross-purposes with state preemption?
Yeah, it gets a little complicated. There are certain initiatives, right, there's certain philosophical tenets in ALEC, like, for example, the anti-unionism that seem to preempt the philosophy of where government power should lie. So, in a way, the right-to-work thing was an example of them taking the opposite of the usual tactic. What happened in Kentucky, as I understand it, was that there was a state right-to-work law that sort of stalled. And I mean, I'm sure that in Wisconsin you know all about the right-to-work laws, but
yes.
You know, designed to limit union power by sapping membership dues. And the right-to-work law stalled at the state level in Kentucky, and so ACCE, the American City County Exchange, drafted a local right-to-work law, and they passed it in, I think they passed it in about a dozen counties in Kentucky. Yeah, so let's see here. They passed it in, it looks like 11, yeah, a dozen Kentucky counties in total. And then a Kentucky court found that the law was actually preempted by the National Labor Relations Act, which left labor bargaining power to the states. So, yes, an ironic twist where they were unsatisfied with the state policy, so they tried to take their the anti-union movement to the local level, and then they found that that might actually be a state power in the end. And then that's still working its way through the court, and there's a similar situation in Illinois where a suburb of Chicago has also drafted this sort of model policy of the ACCE. So we'll have to keep an eye on how.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. Dave, thanks for your call. Gail in Fish Creek, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about how much of the ALEC jurisdictions and things that are coming out now that seem to be over the last 3 years really kind of on steroids, so to speak. As some of my friends would say, how does that fly in with being under a different clause so that municipalities and local governments and things have, and people, citizens, have absolutely no jurisdiction about not putting some of these things into play or not being able to put other things into play that help their citizenry? And one of them is how much... are businesses and major corporations benefiting from this? These new laws and governing statutes and things. How does that play into the Agenda 21 that's been going on? That is that UN project.
What's that? I don't know anything about that. What is it?
Oh, well, you should find out about Agenda 21. It's been around for quite some time. There's actually a book out about it, and it comes from the United Nations.
Neil, do you know about this, Henry?
I do. I do know about Agenda.
Okay.
Agenda 21, in case you're not familiar with it, is a non-binding UN ordinance from the early 90s that, you know, it's sort of a vague feel-good statement about sustainability and environmentalism, but it's turned into this sort of conspiracy theory on the fringe right. Glenn Beck is somebody who's really likes talking about Agenda 21, about how the government is trying to pack everybody into cities and dictate the way that people should live and, you know, take away your guns and your single-family home and all that. It's funny that you mentioned Agenda 21 because Agenda 21 is often invoked at the local level in opposition to liberalizing zoning laws. So when cities are, or say a suburb is trying to, you know, put a bike lane on the road and allow for two or three-story buildings instead of one-story buildings, inevitably somebody will come around and say, no, we're not falling for this Agenda 21 plot. I guess one interesting thing about Agenda 21 is that it relates to local zoning. And I think a lot of urbanites now feel that zoning is an issue where actually we could use a little bit of conservative influence or a little bit of free market influence, because in a lot of super progressive cities like New York and San Francisco, the zoning code is so restrictive that we're really suffering from a serious housing shortage.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of people who are out there saying, you know, if only there were a free market voice here saying, you know what, let's free up construction. Let's let builders build bigger and build easier and not tie them up for years getting permits. So one of the things that I was looking for when I went to the conference in Indianapolis was hoping that there would be some preemption law there that would be saying, you know what, let's take the zoning power and give it to the state, because maybe land use decisions should not be made on a local level, because, you know, I mean, the history of local land use decisions is really just a history of racial exclusion. A homeowners association is racial covenants, that kind of stuff. So it turns out to be not the case. In fact, zoning is one of the only issues where what I heard at the ACCE was that should be a local issue. So you want to talk about bathroom laws, that's for the state. You want to talk about plastic bag bans, that's up to the state. Paid sick leave, that's up to the state. Land use, that stays local.
Why?
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, ultimately, land use is just, it's a super sensitive issue and one that cuts across party lines in an interesting way. I mean, I think some of the, at least in, I think, you know, restrictive zoning policies can be quite segregationist, and I think the Obama administration has done a lot to try and ensure that wealthy American communities are taking some affordable housing and building, you know, so, because, you know, to try and reduce socioeconomic segregation, basically. And you know, there's, to some extent, they're obligated to do so, too, under the Fair Housing Act. But you know, it's a tremendously contentious issue, and when you watch city politicians wade into this debate and start saying, you know, let's build a little more affordable housing, what have you, you know, even in super liberal cities where people are nominally in favor of affordable housing, they'll say, well, you know, yes, but not in my neighborhood.
Right, right. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking with the author of a piece in Slate magazine, The Shackling of the American City. Local governments want to set their own minimum wages, gun laws, and smoking bans. State houses have methodically stripped away their powers to do so. Here's our phone number for Henry. Henry Grabar is our guest, the author of the piece. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll be back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Henry. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to raise one area that you have has not appeared in the list that you've done of the state preempting local authority. Is in Wisconsin is environmental protections and life quality of life protections for the citizenry in favor of businesses is the state preempting local and county authority to regulate frac sand mining.
Mm-hmm.
And that is definitely that's a land use that the state has, land use decisions that the state has grabbed away from the local level.
Henry.
Yeah, that's true, and I think that is, to some extent, that opposes the essential lack of a coherent political philosophy at work here. I mean, ultimately, it's about power. And, you know, regulation occurs at the state level, right? That's the thesis, unless it's about zoning or land use, right? Unless when it's about fracking or the environment, and then it becomes grounds for preemption again. There's actually in Texas, I don't know if you know about Denton, Texas, it's a town to pass a fracking ban, and they're being preempted by the state on that issue. So the state is actually saying no city, county, town jurisdiction may pass a ban on fracking. You know, that is indeed a good example of a local land use issue that is being subject to preemption.
Hmm. Anything else? Oh, Stella's gone. Thank you very much for your call and broadening the conversation to that area. I would imagine there might be more than a few communities, although they're benefiting financially as well in Oklahoma, though, that might want to put a ban on fracking for a while. Has that been attempted in Oklahoma?
I don't know that it has been attempted in Oklahoma, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it become an issue going forward. And I think, you know, you're going to have often what happens with these preemption laws is that once, and this is in part thanks to ALEC, which brings together legislators to share policies that are working in their various states, but also generally just the way that policy works in this country. You know, legislators will look at other states and say, what's working here? And I think that could happen with the fracking, with the ban on fracking bans, because that is also what we've seen with the ban on plastic bag bans, which is an ALEC model policy and has now passed, I think, in five or six states, several of which there is not even a municipality with a plastic bag ban on the table or anywhere near the table.
Oh.
So it's sort of preemptive preemption, saying the equivalent of saying to the states, cities, don't even think about it. So there was a recent Arizona law that said no city, town, jurisdiction, et cetera, in this state may enact any sort of requirements on businesses related to employee scheduling. And that was designed to stop cities from passing laws requiring that employers give employees some notice about shift changes,
mm-hmm.
Which is a progressive law that has been enacted in several cities around the country, but not, however, in Arizona. So that was the state equivalent of don't even think about it. And there's quite a few of those.
Well, that's interesting. Well, you could call it progressive or not. It just seems fair, right, to know if a shift change shouldn't have to have a partisan kind of label, but I guess it does these days. Some of the others we should mention, you mentioned in your article, Arizona preempting the power of Phoenix to stop pet stores from selling dogs bred at puppy mills. Kansas, this one is inexplicable to me, banning local incentives for markets or stores in food deserts. Really?
Yeah, Kansas has a really expansive preemption bill about incentives for anything related to agriculture. And I think right now no one's really sure how that's going to play out because it is brand new. But it could potentially be interpreted really broadly. And cities do sometimes provide incentives for, say, a supermarket to locate in a food desert, which would be illegal under the law.
Hmm.
So we'll see about that. I mean, the Arizona case is an interesting one. That's one where the governor of Arizona preempted laws that existed in Phoenix and Tucson, saying those laws said basically that no pet store may sell a dog that comes from a puppy mill. In other words, if you want to sell puppies and dogs in the storefront window, they have to be sheltered dogs or rescue dogs or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a movement that's really taken off at the local level. I mean,
right.
Something like almost 200 cities that have passed such laws and big places and not necessarily progressive places either. I mean, you got Los Angeles in there, sure, but you've also got Las Vegas and Salt Lake County, which includes Salt Lake City, which is pretty conservative. So, I think puppies are something that people can generally agree on across the aisle, and animal welfare generally. But Arizona actually preempted that because they said it was not business friendly. So puppy mill puppies are back in the shops in Phoenix and Tucson. And another thing to say about the puppy mill bill is that that's one of those ones where it's not really clear where business stands. I was talking to the guy from the Humane Society who's in charge of their puppy mill campaign. He said that I think 24 of the 25 biggest pet store chains in the country have already stopped selling puppy mill.
Well, they have. Huh.
Yeah, so it's pretty much mainstream in at least in the world of corporate pet stores. So I think that that's a case where a lot of those businesses that have already gotten on board with this would probably favor such a law because they're already in compliance.
Right. But
there is an industry there on the other side too. There's 2 million dogs that are raised in puppy mills every year. So
we go to Richard in Madison next. Hello, Richard.
Hello. And I was wondering if your guest had read the Center for Media and Democracy's report, A State Held Hostage, published in 2011, in which all the laws that are sponsored by ALEC are written by ALEC, but are sponsored by different Republicans. To the teeth. It's amazing how controlled our state legislature is.
It's amazing how these really are cookie-cutter pieces of legislation. They're pretty much the same in all states, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, sometimes they change a bit from state to state. And, you know, it's hard to say. I reached out to a lot of sponsors of this type of legislation who are not interested in discussing it with me. But I think, you know, I think ever since the Center for Media and Democracy's report, not only about Wisconsin, but about ALEC model policies more generally, where they released this big library, that really brought a lot of attention to the way that these policies were spread and the fact that they were enacted in state after state with basically boilerplate language. And, you know, on the one hand, you feel like, well, so what if it's boilerplate language? You know, if it's a law that works and it's well written and it's something you need in your state, then why not pass it? But I think it didn't sit right with a lot of people because they feel like, you know, every state is so different that to be taking a law and just copy-pasting from one state house to another, I think that you know, it didn't sit well with people.
Yeah.
So, you know, now when you look at a bill like the paid sick leave bill, which I sort of tracked down in the dozen state legislatures where it's passed, you see subtle changes in the language, and there's concepts that remain the same throughout, but I think that, you know, I think this is my speculation on my part, but I think that because of that backlash, it might now be sort of in vogue to alter the language and sort of make it appear like an idea is actually coming out of your state and not out of some other state.
Well, you'd also like the idea
of a corporate boardroom.
Yeah, exactly. You vote for your legislators and you anticipate that they are going to be the ones fashioning the legislation, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, a lot of these legislators, they're it's a part-time job for them. Most of the year, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're small business people. And, you know, they make a pretty meager salary, too. So I think that, you know, if you'd like to have a professional legislature, then, you know, the solution to that is to make being a legislator a full-time job where all you do is, you know, think about policy and study what works in other cities and other states and other countries. And that's pretty far from the model we have. And I think there's a lot of reasons why it makes sense to have legislators who have, you know, who are not full-time politicians, not career politicians. But to expect that somebody who, you know, spends most of the year running a farm and then comes up to the state legislature and is going to be able to write, you know, a 40-page law about employer scheduling mandates that passes muster with the courts, to me, you know, that's, you know, I think you sort of have to have it one way or another. You know, there's going to be help writing laws on both sides, no matter what the policy is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Henry, thank you very much for being with us. It was a great article, and thanks for sharing it with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Henry Grubauer is a journalist. His piece is in the current issue of Atlantic. It's on our Facebook page, I believe. He writes about cities, systems, maps, and machines. He's a staff writer at Slate. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Tomorrow during this hour, Maureen Dowd is going to be joining us, New York Times columnist who always has a lot to say, to talk about her new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. And please stay tuned next hour as we talk about the life of our 43rd president, George W. Bush.